Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 71, we're in Washington, D.C., where we'll be talking about leading by example when it comes to urban mobility.
When you're in a built environment, you really have to look at reallocating space away from cars and back to people, because it's really about moving people.
That was Washington, D.C.'s very own transport czar, Gabe Klein. And what's it like reporting on the U.S. when you're an Arabic news channel's man in Washington?
My job is not to make America palatable to the Arabs. My job is to reflect America and to cover America with all its dimensions, words and all.
That was Hisham Mellem, bureau chief of Al Arabiya here in D.C. And it wouldn't be a trip to the nation's capital without checking in on one of the country's most colorful pundits, Arianna Huffington. She has a new book out and she'll be here to tell us more about the U.S.'s fractured backbone.
We have the opposite of the American dream. We have downward mobility instead of upward mobility.
And now, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, September 19th, 2010, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in Washington, D.C., at a radio station called WAMU, which sounds like a whale from Canada, I think. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with Andrew Tuck, our culture editor, Robert Bound, and our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. He managed to hit your wagon to your suitcase, didn't he, Andrew?
Yeah, he seems to be wherever I go now.
I don't know who's manning the fort in London this week. Rob, you came by train. I mean, not across the Atlantic.
Yeah.
But you were in New York beforehand.
I was in New York beforehand.
Was it nice to you?
It was. Good they named it twice. that's how I always like to think of it. Yeah, no, it was good. We had a day of sun, we had a day of rain.
And because the sun is out, you've got green pants on today.
Yeah.
I like them.
Do you like them?
I really like the green
pants. I could see you looking at them.
Yeah, they're very Kermit.
You were reserving your judgment on them, weren't you?
Didn't Sesame Street come from Washington, D.C. or don't, Philadelphia?
I don't know, actually.
I don't know.
What, Jim Henson or Sesame Street?
Well, I thought the program.
If you turn right at the end of the radio studio.
Was it New York
then? Actually.
Could be, actually.
Are you thinking of Kermit Legs?
Exactly, Kermit Legs. Yeah. As long as you're not Oscar the Grouch. Oh. Did they have Sesame Street in the U.K.?
Yes. They did, yeah.
And I think the terrible thing was when you were a child, you presumed it was a British program. There was nothing.
But they didn't have accents. Yeah, I mean, it was the same. It wasn't like a franchise version.
No, it was just the same thing.
It was like shot on the back streets of Liverpool or something.
It was the same one.
Oh, okay. I like that in Germany. It's called Sesamstrasse.
I like that too.
It's good, isn't it?
I think it probably is dubbed there, though, isn't it?
I believe so.
They've all got all the voiceover artists are from Bristol.
It was Sesame Crescent in England.
Andrew, as we're into the new season right now, we thought that, and just because Story of the Week was so popular, there were so many emails about it last week that people wanted you to start because you sort of had.
Okay, well, mine's the less successful
story of the week.
Oh, hold on. I think Rob's was more down the useless scale than mine. But anyway, mine isn't a kind of an international story in the sense, but it was a very good friend. I was away at the weekend for a friend's birthday, and a very good friend of mine, Paul, was listening into a conversation I was having with someone who was quizzing me about the kind of the world of Monocle, and was quizzing me about our circulation model and our distribution model as well. And about 20 minutes later, my friend Paul...
Party on.
At this point, we sailed out to sea.
My very nice friend Paul, about 20 minutes later, had obviously been kind of mulling it over, and he said, "Is the distribution model that guy with the beard?" And I was like, "It's not a model, it's the business model.
Hang out with your blonde friends again, will we?" Yeah. Lots of tanning oil.
So anyway, it became a theme of the weekend, all weekend people were saying, "Is that your business model over there, that guy with the beard?"
I love that.
Okay, Steve, over to you. Do you have the same story?
It's not the same story.
Oh,
no,
my goodness.
No, thankfully.
You didn't come with me.
You didn't take him to the party.
It was cheaper booking by Ibiza, wasn't it?
Yeah. Now, there have been times where I haven't been with Andrew this week. My story of the week, in fact, it was very recent. It was is my arrival in America. I've always noticed when I've come back...
I think this is my story as well. But anyway, go on.
No. Oh, I hope not. whenever I've come back to the UK, when I used to be based in Nairobi, I've always been struck by how negative and just how depressing it is to come back to Heathrow Airport. Mm. And there's no sign saying, "Welcome to Britain." No one's friendly about it. There's all signs saying, "If you're rude to us, we will arrest you." if you want to seek asylum here, maybe think again. It's all, depressingly negative. When I arrived in America for this show, it was actually quite positive. I mean, aside from the guy was a little bit rude to me, but he did say "Welcome to America," and he was, he did say "Have a nice day," and I think that's a nice little touch. Even if he, sounded a bit bored and didn't look at me when he said it, you know, I think it's still, he's making an effort. They're trying.
Rob, it looks like he has the warm fuzzies, doesn't it?
He does, doesn't he?
I can see them. It's not just because your shirt's undone.
Yeah, exactly. It's undone. I've undone it another notch, actually. My story of the week is a bit similar to Andrew. I think maybe the your mate Paul thought that distribution model was our friend Patrick, who's graced the cover.
Yes.
And randomly had a bit of a night out with him in New York last night.
Oh, very nice.
A sort of friend of a friend said, oh, I've got a mate coming to the bar. I was like, oh, okay. And it turned out to be Patrick. So it was rather amusing. So I have also had an amusing a distribution model moment.
Goodness.
Nice. It's a small world, isn't it?
Okay, I can either do story of the week or I can do salty oats. Sasha, our man in Washington, bought these all the way from Hyannisport. I'm not sure if he bought them in Hyannisport. There's a Whole Foods next to the studio. He might have got them there as well. But I'm going to share these as sort of a bit of a Sunday brunch in D.C. this morning.
Always happy to have some.
And I like sort of the raffia. I don't know if he did this sort of the raffia tie-up himself, but it's very homemade and very cozy.
Do you think there's a choice of wrapping when you buy them? And you go, well, I'm doing a radio show, so I want the most crinkly thing
no, exactly.
you've got available. Do you want it in a paper bag? No, cellophane.
No, give me as much cellophane. Triple wrap cellophane, please. Please. Anyway. Go crazy. Help yourself, Steve. Quickly, my story of the week is I don't have the warm fuzzies over Dulles because when I landed, I think they're all eight aircraft. There was a flight from Jeddah. There was an ANA flight from Tokyo. There was one from Copenhagen. There was a Virgin flight. There was a BA flight. Air France flight. Qatar flight. They all landed within 20 seconds of each other.
Sweet.
So there was probably about 1,000 to 1,200 people in the customs hall in the non-US line. And just as I was sort of pulling up to the queue, there was an announcement. It said, excuse me, all immigration staff who do not want to stay for overtime, please leave your post. So at this point, you saw all of these lights go off and there were about four people left. And I was there for 90 minutes.
Oof.
My at God. A time in a week when they've been saying that they're charging us, what, $14 or $15 now to come into the country to get these ESTA things because they want to promote tourism to the United States. That was my welcome to America.
I take mine back.
Okay.
I was obviously lucky.
And really kind of bad kind of management of your expectations to hear them say.
Yeah, I thought, just send out an email, tweet about it, do something. Yeah. But I don't want to hear that sort of over the loudspeaker. Anyway, a little later in the program, we're going to be talking to our new permanent man in Washington, Sasha Eisenberg. But before that, we thought it might be interesting to find out what it's been like reporting for an Arabic news channel amid the controversy surrounding the Islamic Center near Ground Zero, and also a fresh round of Middle East peace talks. Hisham Elam is Washington Bureau Chief of Al Arabiya, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's been quite an interesting week. We've seen the Secretary of State out on the road again. I guess as a starting point, how do you report this? Because obviously, we've seen the rise of course, Al Arabiya, one or two of your competitors as well. As a brand which is popping up on international screens, I think with greater frequency now, I think it'd be interesting to know what's the line that a network like yours takes on this story? And also, how much do you feel you also have to differentiate your pitch versus what the BBC's Arabic service is doing, what France 24 has to do, and all of the others?
Well, now with the proliferation of the satellite technology in the Arab world, you have an incredible plethora of choices. And fortunately or unfortunately, I'll probably say unfortunately, most Arabs today are like most Americans, probably Europeans. I don't know about Americans and Arabs. They get their news, most of their news from television. So television and satellite television in the Arab world in the last 10, 15 years have become powerful tools. And they act sometimes like powerful NGOs, especially in societies where we lack organized political parties and we're in societies where civil society is not very strong yet. So everybody watches television and their influence is tremendous. And many people believe that this new technology could lead to new kind of politics in the Arab world. The jury is still out on this. But definitely these television stations are important shapers of public opinion in the Arab world, including in societies that are run and led by autocrats. Mm. So when you have something like a resumption of the peace talks, of course, we look at it from the Arab perspective in the sense that how the resumption of talks is important to the Palestinians in the first place and to the wider Arab world. The impact on Palestinian society, on Hamas, on those who are for the resumption of talks and those who are opposed to them for a variety of reasons. So our approach and our focus is naturally somewhat different than a typical American network or European network. I mean, in the United States, they probably talk, what is the impact on the Obama administration or on the midterm elections? It doesn't mean we ignore that. That's part of the story, but this is not necessarily the main focus, the main concern, or the main driving power behind the way we approach a story like that. Take, for instance, what happened last week, for the lack of a better word, the lunacy in Florida. An insignificant pastor, quote-unquote, probably, with his limited, tiny flock, quote-unquote, created an international uproar. And that tells you something about the nature of our business, how it changed in the last few years. I mean, this is the globalized world.
Well, how did you approach, just give us an example, how did you approach that story?
We were the first, probably the first Arab network that sent a reporter to Florida. I sent one of my reporters to Florida to be there. And the challenge for us was not only to cover it, but how to cover it. And you want to do it in a way that you would avoid responsibly. And again, you know, editors and reporters discuss these issues every day in every editorial room in the world, actually. How you do it responsibly, how you do it in a way that would not incite misunderstanding or even violence, this is a very sensitive issue. And we did it, and we kept in our background what happened in the Arab world and in the Muslim world after the Abu Ghraib pictures were released, and after the cartoons of the Prophet were released, and the violence that occurred afterwards. So we were extremely sensitive in covering it. We want to cover it, obviously. But again, just put it in context. How to contextualize something like that is a great challenge. And we kept in contact with each other here in Florida and Dubai, where Al Arabiya is headquartered. And I think we did a good job, but it was really a tough week. I mean, especially when it ended in New York with the 9th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks.
I'm going to throw it open to my other colleagues in a moment. But I'm also wondering, you know, where we've seen this proliferation of Arab news channels now as well, you know, with bureaus in this country. I'm also wondering just what it's like on the ground, you know, day to day. You know, are people also surprised when you go into some of the hotbeds in this country as well to say, oh, here's someone who's actually pitching up from, you know, a station which might be headquartered in Dubai or might be headquartered in Doha. I mean, once upon a time, they might have seen someone from the BBC. They might have seen someone from CBC. But now they're also seeing correspondents from Arabic networks as well.
Our name is becoming more and more familiar to many Americans. You'll be surprised. Our name, Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera and others are becoming familiar names. And sometimes, you know, we don't necessarily have the kind of negative baggage that other people may have. But we're still alien to some people. And it's difficult sometimes to introduce yourself, especially when you're dealing with an unfolding, you know, breaking news story. And sometimes people don't want to collaborate with you or they don't want to talk to you because, you know, they're not interested in talking to a foreign audience or international audience. You get that. But sometimes people are friendly and they want to engage you. When it comes to policymakers in Washington, most people know Al Arabiya, most people know Al Jazeera, most people know LBC, most people know Nile Television, and especially those who are interested in the Middle East. But again, you know, sometimes when you talk to the talking heads of Washington, they may not be interested because they are not going to watch it on CNN. It's going to be dubbed into Arabic, or there will be a voiceover in Arabic. So you deal with these things. But essentially, the demarcation lines between satellite stations in the Arab world or in Europe or in the United States are being blurred. We use their footage, they use our footage, we interview them, they interview us. That's why it's a changing world, it's a changing media, and the story is still unfolding.
I wanted to ask you a question, which is, when Al Jazeera first came to this country, there were many people who were very suspicious of it because they felt the kind of footage they were seeing put out, especially on the Arabic language version, was too critical of America. And it's interesting the way you talk now about the sensitivity in which you covered the Florida story. Has there been a turnaround in the key people in departments here? Do you find yourself actually in the other position now, being courted by people who realize that if they can get you, not persuade you, but if they can give you access that allows you to give a story that's a bit more balanced, you may persuade people in the Middle East to be more sympathetic to American view. Are you finding that there's lobbyists coming for you?
It's not a secret that the Bush administration in particular, quote-unquote, rediscovered the Arab media after the invasion of Iraq in particular, but also after 9/11, but particularly after the invasion of Iraq. And they would seek us out to talk to us because they knew that we are reaching millions of Arab viewers. And they discovered that there is such a thing as, quote-unquote, public opinion, including in those countries that are run by autocratic and even repressive regimes. So they wanted to get their story out. So we understand that. I mean, if you want to be blunt about it, they use us and we use them in that sense. And it's just, if somebody offers you as a BBC or CNN, they say the president of the United States would like to talk to you, you're not going to say no. Your job is to do a good job, but you cannot say no. And we seek them. I mean, when I got my first interview with Barack Obama, I've been chasing him as a candidate, you know, in the preceding months in the summer, and I knew some of his advisors, and I was writing emails for them because I appeared with them on television, I lectured with them, and I've known them for many years. So, you do this. But there is no doubt that America's foreign policy in the Arab and the Muslim world is facing tremendous challenges. America has an image problem in the Arab and the Muslim world. And even the Bush administration, which contributed a lot to make that image very negative, realized this later on. And Obama, from the beginning, he realized this, even when he was running as a candidate. So my job is not to make America palatable to the Arabs. My job is to reflect America and to cover America with all its dimensions, words and all. We are sensitive for a simple reason. I cannot afford to make a mistake, because a mistake can lead to the death of people. Let me give you an example. When President Bush, and we all know President Bush is not the most articulate, erudite American president, when he said initially after 9/11, this is a campaign, this is a crusade. That word, the minute he uttered it, I got a shiver down my spine, because I realized immediately that that word is going to be interpreted by many people in the Middle East in its medieval sense, which means the sword in one hand and the crucifix in the other. I translated it as a campaign, because you and I know every American president loves to wage a crusade against something. If it's not crime, it's poverty, it's drugs, it's you name it. This is like the crusade du jour. Other people translated it as crusade in medieval sense. And you know what that means? You know, a few years ago, there was an erroneous report in Newsweek that somebody flushed a copy of the Quran in Gitmo. 15 people died in Pakistan or Afghanistan after the cartoons of the Prophet. We had similar situations. I have to deal with certain things that your typical bureau chief in Washington or in London doesn't have to deal with. You know, you don't want it on your conscience.
As you've mentioned, a lot of the countries where Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera broadcast are run by dictators, autocrats. How do you feel that, you know, those satellite news channels, including your own, have helped to change politics within the Middle East? Or if they haven't, how they could in the future?
I mean, some of the things I do from my position here is to cover those aspects of life in America that appeal to people who live in autocratic societies. When you talk about empowerment, when you talk about minority rights, when you talk about women's involvement in politics, when you talk about democratic give and take. I'll tell you what, last Friday, we had an extended show called The End of the Week. It's like a, you know, review of what happens during the week. One of the questions that we got last week, the same question was, how come the president of the United States cannot stop this man in Florida? I mean, keep in mind, these are people who live in centralized authority where the ruler, the king, the sheikh, whatever, or the president can stop something like that. Even in Europe, by the way, they can stop it. In the name of national security, in anything. And I tried to explain to them that there is something called the American Constitution, which supersedes everything in this country. And that this is not only a federal issue, it's a local issue, state. We had to translate the Bill of Rights. We talked about the Bill of Rights. We did a piece on particularly the First Amendment. We translated it in Arabic. I worked with the editor there, how to phrase it and whatever. I had to talk to them after they aired that piece just to explain to them what is the Bill of Rights, what is the First Amendment, and how come an American citizen not only has the right to burn the Bible and the Quran and every sacred text, but he can burn the American flag and the President of the United States cannot stop him. That's my way of telling people about democracy. Now, maybe I'm engaged in something here that is somewhat, you know, on behalf of democracy. But, well, you know, if that's the case, I plead guilty. I do it that way, you know.
I wanted to ask you about the subtlety, actually, of the reporting and, you know, talking about the idea of the crusade. Did you not mention the word as it would be translated into Arabic at all? Did you decide to skate over that word because you knew how it would be taken in the Arab world? Or did you tell the story behind the story and explain what it would mean?
That's an excellent question. In my writings, when I wrote about it for my paper, I didn't explain the word. I said it's a hamla. In Arabic, hamla is a campaign. Uh-huh. But I had my weekly program at that time on Al-Arabiya, and we discussed it. We talked about the roots of the word and how the president, I believe that George Bush misspoke. Now, later on, he used a kind of metaphysical religious language when he talks about Islamofascism and the evildoers and all of that. I mean, he used that metaphysical language, which was extremely combustible. And if you notice, Obama doesn't use that. In fact, George Bush talks about the war on terror, about on Islamic extremists. Barack Obama doesn't talk about that. He talks about a war against a specific enemy, and that enemy is named Al-Qaeda and all affiliated groups. So there's a huge difference in concept, in the way he conceptualized the war on terror. And in fact, doesn't even call it a war on terror. Because the war on terror, and terror is a tactic, so you cannot wage a war on tactic. I mean, terrorism is not—it's not an enemy. It's not a well-defined enemy. It's not an ideology. That's why you have right-wing terrorists, left-wing terrorists, Marxist terrorists, religious terrorists, Christian terrorists, Muslim terrorists, Jewish terrorists—you name it. So it's more complex. You're right. The subtlety, you cannot do it sometimes in a soundbite. If you have a program like, you know, where you have serious discussions that goes beyond the soundbite, you can explain these subtleties and differences, you know, when you translate concepts like that from English to Arabic.
Just on that notion of subtlety, do you think, and not to go back to the language of Bush, and maybe even over the last week, you know, with the Secretary of State out in the region, give us a quick tutorial. I mean, you mentioned LBC, you talk about Al Jazeera, you know, when you're flipping channels, how is everyone else telling that story? I mean, you know, is there, because obviously if you look at Al Jazeera, you go back to the 2006 war in Lebanon, you know, a country which was, you know, Doha suddenly became, you know, an adjective for peace in, sure, in many ways. You know, was the rhetoric very different from their broadcasters versus the way Al Arabiya covered it?
There are certain terminologies we don't use, or they use and we don't use. I personally don't like martyrdom operations. It's a suicide operation. When the Israelis and the Palestinians fight, we talk about casualties. I don't give them, in Arabic, most newspapers and satellite stations refer to them as martyrs. We had a problem at one time when Palestinians fight Palestinians, or what do you call the victims? Martyrs? I mean, civilians are civilians, clearly. Soldiers are soldiers. When somebody fights an occupying army, let's say Israel occupied South Lebanon for a long time, I'll give you an example that I'm very comfortable with, right? And then the Lebanese fought against that occupation. When Israeli soldiers fell on occupied Lebanese soil, you cannot call that terrorism. These are armed people in a place where they shouldn't be. Now, when you blow up a bus full of civilians, and I don't care whether that bus is in Dublin or in Haifa or in Grozny or in Kashmir, that act in and of itself is an act of terror, regardless of the cause that is being used to justify it. I mean, one has to be careful about that. Some in the Arab media, I don't want to name them, during the worst years in American presence in Iraq, any kind of action against the Americans, any kind of violence, was referred to as resistance. Now, it's more complex than that, because the violence that occurred in Iraq, let's say in 2006, 7, 8, all right, when you had really terrible violence, it was a combination of people resisting the American occupation, people engaged in pure acts of terror, and people engaged in criminality, good old-fashioned criminality. So you cannot lump all of these things and call them resistance just because you, editorially speaking, are against the American military presence or against the military occupation in Iraq. I was opposed to the American invasion of Iraq, but I cannot. This is different than, I mean, that editorial position or philosophical position or whatever political position call it, that different how you covered the war there. And it's difficult for many people to do that. I mean, many Arabs, by the way, did not believe that Arabs or Muslims were responsible for 9/11. I mean, it's hogwash, obviously, and we don't have to play that game. So you had people denying this and accusing the CIA, accusing the Mossad. I mean, there was a great deal of mythology around it. And sometimes you have to say some very unpleasant things to people who are watching you when you say it in Arabic and look them directly in the eye and telling them that, you know, what they're hearing from other sources is totally baseless.
Hisham Alam, bureau chief for Al Arabiya here in Washington, D.C. Hopefully you'll be back again, or we'll be back here. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly in D.C. We're back after this. You're back with The Monocle Weekly here in Washington, where it already feels like the Christmas decorations could hit shop windows any day now, as the U.S. gears up for its biggest consumer push of the year. For authors, this means it's touring season, and one of the titles that's already destined for stockings and downloads is Arianna Huffington's Third World America, that centers on how the U.S. has slid from economic and political superpower during the last century to a nation in danger of becoming a broken banana republic. Is the American dream swiftly turning into a nightmare, and is extinction just around the corner for America's middle class? Arianna Huffington is editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, and she poses those questions and many more, and she's on the line from Boston. Hello, Arianna.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Has this book been a long time in coming?
Yes, it
it's been about a year, and it really came as a result of my concern about what's happening to the middle class in this country, and indeed in your country, whose job losses, foreclosures, bankruptcies. We have the opposite of the American dream. We have downward mobility instead of upward mobility. And the middle class is the foundation of American prosperity and American democracy. So I wanted to write a book that sounds the alarm about what this would mean for this country if we don't course correct.
How much of this is a history lesson versus it being really a contemporary commentary?
Well, it's very much a contemporary commentary, but it ends with a very positive section on solutions, because I believe that we have the power to turn things around, not just by waiting for government to do the right thing, but if we start doing the right things in our own community, giving back, building our financial literacy, tapping into our own resilience so that we don't move into despair when we lose jobs or homes, and basically rebuilding our communities.
I mean, one area that the book focuses on is the fact that the backbone of the nation, the economic, engine, has been manufacturing, that this was a country that always made things, and that this is obviously has very much gone by the wayside. And I'm wondering what's presented in terms of solutions in that area. Is it only about buying America? But, how do we bring things back from Southeast Asia and elsewhere?
Well, I believe that first of all, we need to recognize the urgency. When all the American establishments recognized the urgency of saving the financial system from collapse, they came around and literally over the weekend, they threw everything against the wall and they saved Wall Street. Well, we need to bring the same urgency. We have an amazing amount of things that we are not doing, allowing individuals to be able to modify their loans, to be able to save in their homes. We have had almost 3 million homes foreclosed in 2009, and we're going to have more in 2010.
How much does the book also look outside of the United States? I mean, obviously, from a Monocle perspective, we're always looking at benchmarks elsewhere. And I think one of the things that we tend to focus on from time to time is that you don't have to spend tens of millions, billions to build a new model. There are many interesting models all over the world that one can follow. And I'm wondering if you look to solutions that have also been established elsewhere.
Well, absolutely. In fact, what is ironic? I'm here at the other Cambridge at Harvard today, and we have been talking about that at this lunch. I was speaking with David Gergen about how we actually are now seeing a lot of things that have been done, a lot of innovations in the third world, including microcredit, and we are importing them into this country. Because when you have certain urban areas here that have 50% unemployment, we need to bring a lot of the innovations around how to use cell phones for banking, how to bring in microcredit that were invented out of necessity in the third world.
Great. Ariana, we just because the line is getting a bit scratchy, we're going to have to leave you, but we look forward to reading the book. Ariana Huffington, thank you very much. Third World America.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Andrew, it's interesting when you look at governments, and I think sometimes we point to how quick our brothers and sisters in journalism are to sort of jump on the case of various leaders and ministers because they go off on international tours, and frequently they're seen as sort of being just a big jolly, and it's to go and do a bit of a meet and greet. But there are very interesting lessons to be learned elsewhere, and I think when Ariana sort of also referenced our own government, would you sort of be up for an aircraft that actually took ministers and secretaries elsewhere to actually learn some lessons? Rather than going out and spending, tens of millions to sort of, rebuild something which has been well established elsewhere.
And I think the funny thing is that politicians seem to be willing to do that more when they're in opposition than when they get into power. So when, in the UK, for example, many ministers, when they're in opposition, were willing to come to the States to see things about, zero tolerance. They went to Sweden to look at kind of models of social security or banking. But when they get into power, it seems they're very nervous that they would look abroad for any solutions. So suddenly it becomes very, very insular. And it's, I'm sure that's one of the reasons that governments soon kind of run out of momentum, is that they're an unwillingness to kind of look beyond their borders suddenly once they're in power.
I mean, Steve, it's funny that, you know, here Ariana's talking to us on a rather sort of scratchy line from Harvard, but she said, you know, that they were talking about even potential solutions from the third world and saying that, you know, that maybe we should be looking at, you know, microfinance models involving mobile phones, which, you know, as we've read, are sort of very well established in many African economies.
They are, and not just Africa as well, but I mean, I think, you know, microcredit, the best example really is Bangladesh, where the Grameen Bank set up by Mohamed Yunus has been a huge success. So much so that he's actually exported that model now to Britain. They recently opened one in Glasgow and also to America. There's one in San Francisco. There's one in New York as well. And so I really like this idea that it's, you know, ideas coming from places like Bangladesh can really be just as useful here in the developed world as they are in the developing world.
Gentlemen, thanks very much. We're going to be coming back to the segment in a moment when we have our very own Sasha Eisenberg here in the studio. You're with the Monocle Weekly in Washington. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's time for a few words on the state of the nation from our man in Washington, Sasha Eisenberg. Is it still Comment Corner this week? I thought there was going to be sort of a wave of letters about how we'd rebrand this new section, but...
Well, there has been some debate whether it should be the monologue.
But, I think it should be.
Yeah.
He thinks the, is it the monologue or just monologue?
I think
is
the, it mono-
the we
monologue.
Need the, we need the... Because it's, okay, it's the monologue. The monologue. The monocolumn.
Yeah. Okay, so it's the monologue.
The Rob.
Etc. Right. The okay. Mono-Rob.
Okay, very good. Here's the monologue with Sasha Eisenberg.
Last week, a Democratic speechwriter named Dylan Lowe published a book, Permanently Blue, with a bit of an attention grabber for its subtitle, How Democrats Can End the Republican Party and Rule the Next Generation. Lowe's optimism is more than a little bit out of sync with his times. Experts have begun the autumn election season by projecting Democrats are likely to lose control of Congress after only 4 years. Lowe has already insulated himself against that kind of headline in November. A bad showing this year, he writes, would be a mere speed bump on the road to one-party rule. This belongs to a lively subgenre in American publishing. In 2002, at the height of George W. Bush's post-September 11th strength, we got the emerging Democratic majority. In 2009, months after Obama's victory, former Clinton advisor James Carville produced a quickie book entitled 40 More Years, How the Democrats Will Rule the Next Generation. These books, and Lowe's, share a basic argument rooted in demographics. Whites, the only racial group that is reliably Republican, comprise a shrinking part of the U.S. population. A liberal, multicolored, pluralistic America, these authors argue, will keep pulling the electoral lever for Democrats. But those long-term trends don't acknowledge voters' much shorter attention spans. Latinos may not become permanently loyal to Republicans, but many of them are disappointed at Obama's disinterest in fighting for new immigration laws. College-educated white women may not abandon the Democrats for good, but they are disappointed that the unemployment rate has only gone up under the current presidency. Indeed, Obama's Democrats are concluding one of the more impressive legislative binges in decades, and all they have to show for it is a more diverse group of enemies. Voters can already see all the risks that come with reforming the health insurance system or big banks, but are told to wait years for the benefits. In this environment, it is getting harder to visualize any sort of major realignment taking place anytime soon. A pendulum swinging back and forth seems like a better image. Voters are very good at becoming disappointed by their current government, and very bad at sustaining any enthusiasm for one. Do nothing parties get thrown out of power? Do something parties get thrown out of power too? As a result, Republicans this year have to agree on little other than the idea that Obama has done too much too quickly, while failing to speedily turn around the economy. There seem to be two types of Republican candidates on the ballot this fall: business people and populists who think business people should be run out of town. They can't even agree on what to call themselves. The livelier candidates, mostly the populists, but some of the business people too, seem happiest when identified as members of the Tea Party movement. The name is only a year and a half old, but the rebranding effort is nearly 4 years in the making.
Throughout the long 2008 campaign, conservatives regularly insisted that the recklessness, corruption, and incompetence of Bush-era congressional Republicans had given their party a bad name. So now they have a new one, inspired by 18th century colonial insurgents and often demonstrating as much discipline. The Tea Party stands for the same things Republicans almost always have: less government, lower taxes. But a new name has given an opening for angry conservatives to support opposition candidates and still feel as though they're free thinkers, too renegade to fit under any party's banner. If the Republicans do win back Congress, such stylistic flexibility won't be an option. The banner will hang over them all. In 2 years, Obama will attack them either as a do-nothing party or a party that has tried to do too much, too quickly. It won't quite matter which is closer to being true. The next round of soothsaying political books may want to focus more on short-term branding than long-term demographics. For Monocle, I'm Sasha Eisenberg.
And Sasha Eisenberg is here in studio. Sasha, I guess the momentum is obviously, you know, heating up at the moment. I mean, what do you think, you know, when we look at and flip the channels between all of the major news networks over here, what are going to be the two or three main talking points, I guess on either side of the fence as well?
Well, I mean, the sort of news is moving against Obama and that the economy isn't getting better. The things that he has succeeded in, which are pretty impressive as matters of legislation, don't seem to be doing much for the creation of jobs and spending. So I think Republicans just want to be talking about that. Anything else is a distraction. Democrats want to sort of get credit for what they've been able to do on healthcare and on financial reform, while at the same time trying to suggest that if they hadn't taken steps for stimulus spending and things would be a lot worse. And so the Democrats have this sort of horrible predicament, which is their best case is, if not for us, we'd be in a depression, and instead we're just in a recession, which is not a real crowd pleaser.
In a week that we've seen, of course, the Secretary of State touring the Middle East, that obviously the parties are pretty much back around the table. Does anything on the foreign policy side even count for anything at this point?
No, I mean, I think there's a little bit of grievance on both sides about Afghanistan and a little bit of credit Obama gets for sort of formally ending the combat effort in Iraq, but I don't think there's a sort of big coalition to be built on either side about that. And in the Middle East, it's possible that he could either alienate or please some number of Jewish voters that could matter in a few states, but otherwise nobody's really being pulled by that.
Sasha, you say that voters are blaming Obama for the problems in the economy. I mean, but how have the Republicans managed to avoid any of the blame for this, since this was a recession that started, the economic crash started on Bush's watch, and he seems to have escape much of the blame for it?
I mean, I think Obama's biggest mistake, which we see retrospectively, is, you know, he's not somebody who's prone to being sort of excitable. And so he came into office and to some degree, and this is, we saw a version of this, I think, with BP. I think we see a version of this with Afghanistan. Things that are like a really big mess, he acts like are not such a huge deal. And so they came into office and said, you know, we have big problems, and this, we have this $800 billion stimulus bill that we think will stop them, and if we pass it, unemployment will go down. He had advisors being on TV a year and a half ago saying that unemployment would be at 8% by the end of the year, and I think they sort of overpromised is sort of the worst of it. If they had been a little more upfront to say the choice is depression or more of the same for a few more years, they probably would have had a worse time of it a year ago, because they would have sounded very cynical, but probably there wouldn't be the sense of disappointment that there is now.
I want to ask a question, which it seems fascinating when you're watching from outside the country, the rise of the Tea Party movement, but just the kind of level of almost violent anger that's placed, you know, in front of Obama. We did a story just a few weeks ago where very openly people are saying things like, you know, I wish he'd be shot, or, you know, he's a secret Muslim. And these amazing statistics that come out where, you know, they do polls and they believe, you know, half of people polled believe he's really Muslim. Do you think that there's a kind of ugly element of racism that perhaps was capped during his election, but which now is being played out?
I think my sense generally, whether it's the race stuff or the Muslim stuff, which is all, I think, connected, is basically people that dislike him now have a sort of new narrative around which to place their suspicions about him. I mean, there was a pretty vehement right-wing opposition to Bill Clinton from the moment he was elected. And at this part in his presidency, you probably could have gone out to parts of the country and found people with pretty violent threats against him. And there, it was a sort of a narrative about him being sleazy and allegations that he and Hillary killed people that had double-crossed them and that he had this sort of wake of drug running in Arkansas. I mean, there were pretty good myths around Clinton, too. Bush had a couple of them, you know, around sort of 9/11 and being too close to the Saudis. I think that these things, people have opponents because of sort of where they are politically, and they these are just sort of very lively images that people who already dislike Obama and sort of don't identify with him can be comfortable in.
You don't think politics are more ugly now than they have been, say, in the last generations? It's just played out in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, it's ugly when there's a sort of questioning whether he's actually an American is a different level of ugliness. And I think questioning whether he's a sort of sleaze like Clinton is, I think the tone and language are rougher now, but I don't actually think that, you know, I think there's always going to be a fifth of the country that hates the president and looks for the sort of most vile language and imagery possible to express it.
So I wondered, it's interesting listening to your monologue.
Thank you.
There it is. It's been christened. <isn't> it? and I wondered if it was the old story of, you know, they say that the Republicans are so good because it always seems like they're telling a story. The problem with the Democrats is it always looks like they're delivering a lecture. Is that something that might be a problem for Obama in that he does have this unexcitable exterior, and that he's still sort of, you know, people that thought he might have done more are kind of disappointed at his sort of lack of histrionics in comparison to the Tea Party and the sort of histrionic right?
I mean, Obama tells a great story at times, and I think that's why the campaign was so successful. The fact is, he's not particularly good about telling stories about the economy. And I think to satisfy people about how bad things are now, you need to have a bigger story about the transformations that are going on in the American economy as to why unemployment is around 10% and looks like it's not going to move in significant ways anytime soon. And he's really bad at that. I mean, his personal experience, he's a lawyer. He has this, I think, really nimble idea for how the global cultures that informs when he talks about foreign policy. This isn't a guy who's had interesting jobs, hasn't had a sort of range of experience in the business world. I think he's actually been an okay manager, but he just, you know, is not somebody who can sort of use his linguistic gifts and apply them to explaining how factory life has changed or why manufacturing isn't where it is now. And, you know, there's a little bit of a success story to be told in Detroit, where the government intervention looks like it has helped GM at least. And Obama's not really good at telling a sort of inspiring, optimistic, hopeful story about that.
Great. Sasha, stick around because we're going to be talking about transport on a local level. Gabe Klein is going to be here, who's our local transport czar, your local transport czar. I'm not taking up residency in Washington anytime soon. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in Washington, where it's time for some culture with Rob Bound and Andrew Tuck and also Steve Bloomfield as well. Everyone sort of encroaching on your patch.
Is everyone going to be, what is this, a barbershop quartet or something?
Something, yeah.
Expect me to come up with.
Yeah, like story of the week, everyone's got something else to play as well.
Everyone's got something up their sleeve.
They do. What do you have up your sleeve?
I've got Wale.
Wale?
I thought he was called Whale, didn't I?
Then you did.
I might as well just
but, you know,
come up with that.
Sometimes the printers or the keyboards, they don't have accents, so.
Exactly.
Is there an accent on it?
There wasn't on the thing I downloaded, no, but anyway.
All right, okay.
We're told that it was. And he's from D.C.
Right.
And he was discovered by Mark Ronson. And this is a song of his from an album called Attention Deficit.
Mm.
You won't have a problem with that after listening to this song. It's quite lively. Here you go.
Chillin', PG chillin', my name Wale, and I came to get it, came to get it, came to get it, my name Wale.
That was, what was it called? Well, that was Wale. What
that was called Chillin'.
Chillin'.
Yeah. No G. Featuring. you could tell that by the way I said it though.
Yeah.
You?
Okay, break it down for us.
So, break it down.
Yeah, break it down. I love it in percentages. It's 40%.
Well, there's a bit of Lady Gaga in there who's duetting, who did the bit at the beginning that sounded a bit like MIA to me.
Really?
Yeah, that was Lady Gaga. Oh. And then I don't know what you break it down in terms of percentages as, but I did hear it coming out of a presidential limo earlier this morning. So if it's good enough for him.
It's good enough for our listeners, yeah, isn't it?
Exactly. And I also have a quieter thing.
Okay.
A friend of ours, Maya Hawthorne and James Pants, I think we saw these records in our shop, have joined forces. They're on brilliant Stone So Records.
Is that because their CDs were side by side in our shops?
Yeah, I mean, they saw us and they thought, wait a minute, there's something beautiful here we're missing out on. And this is off an EP called Pants Plays Maya. This is a little EP and this track is called Thin Moon.
Thank you.
we were able to get right into that.
We didn't really get to the best bit.
No,
we can fast forward to the best bit.
I think we could. I've got a bit of dry mouth as well.
Don't worry about it.
The cookies are quite salty. What do you think of the cookies?
I thought this was the kind of music which you started unbuttoning your shirt to. I can see. Let alone having dry mouth. Now's not the time.
Not a warm bicky.
Exactly.
Is that it?
So that's James Pants, or that's Mayor Hawthorne doing James Pants.
I like it. It's very good. Yeah. Andrew?
It's good, but I think it was a bit unfair to Mr. Pants, because it's quite hard to have Pants post-Wallet.
All right, okay.
Steve, you buying it?
Yeah, no, it's good for a Sunday morning.
Yeah, I don't think we've kind of quite got you. I know it sort of turns Andrew's crank, and I've figured Rob out after almost 4 years, but I don't know, you're a bit of an enigma over there.
Good.
We'll get there in time.
No, I'm going to stay that way.
Okay, do that. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly in Washington, and we're back after this. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly here in Washington this Sunday. Now, a key metric we consider when ranking the world's most livable cities is how good the transport network functions and how easy it is to get on your bike. In this city, one man has been striving to score points in this arena with an array of green transport initiatives and an innovative approach to tackling Washington's transit challenges. A former vice president of Zipcar and director of stores for Bikes USA, the nation's largest bicycle retailer, how's that for a plug? Gabe Klein is now the director of the Department of Transportation for the District of Columbia. And he joins us here in studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for having us to your city. I guess to start, I was this morning I went for a run around town, and I saw quite a bit of commuter traffic. A number of people on bicycles. Didn't see too much overland transport. Of course, saw there were a hell of a lot of cars, and I'm wondering if you could maybe just talk us through, because at the start of the program you wouldn't have heard the intro yet, but we said one has to lead by example, and of course you've got people from who are urban leaders and state leaders and people running municipalities, who are coming here. So what's being done in Washington?
Well, Washington is going through a lot of changes. I think very exciting changes. And it's funny, I was speaking to a group of historic preservationists last week who typically I have a little more of an abrasive relationship with. They actually stood up and gave me applause because I talked a lot about how you have to look to your past to know what your future is. And, a big part of my thesis on not only Washington, D.C., but cities and where we need to go with them is to look back in the past, and not just to look back at 1950, which is what a lot of preservations do, or 1930 or 1940, but look back at 1800s, 1700s, before the combustion engine and before the automobile basically took over our roads. And post-war in D.C., everybody wanted a white picket fence. They started to move out to PG County and Montgomery. Then there was a bit of a collusion to shut down the streetcar system. We had 235 miles of streetcar. And then you had the riots and white flight and crime. And so what we went through is what a lot of cities in America have gone through. And now what we're trying to do is undo the damage and sort of hit the reset button and put the city back to maybe where it was around 1920 or 1930, but utilizing technology to also tie all the different layers of transportation together, because we don't want to ignore that we're in the modern age. And so we have a lot of different initiatives revolving around infrastructure improvements and actual transportation improvements on the street, and then a lot of technology improvements to let people know what services are available.
I guess walk us through, top three initiatives really on sort of the infrastructure side.
Sure.
What's in development?
Well, one program is called the Great Streets Program, and it's actually not a transportation program per se. It's actually a streetscape improvement program. What we do is we basically tear a street down to the utilities and start over and rebuild it with much wider sidewalks, bike lanes, utility improvements. A lot of our utilities are over 100 years old. Sometimes even facade improvements for buildings. I mean, it's a very interesting program. In Columbia Heights, which is now sort of internationally known, it being a new urbanist sort of smart growth example, we took this old burned out area, and I happened to live up there, and we actually reinvented it with a metro station, with new wide sidewalks, big box retail, high density development. So that's one program that we're doing. It's very important. The infrastructure transportation improvements come with it, but they're not the core focus. It's really to stimulate economic growth.
I mean, well, talk me through that community. I mean, I hear sort of, you know, already I hear big box retail and I think, okay, you've got it wrong. Because big box retail normally demands a car.
Exactly. It normally does. So I'll tell you a really interesting little story here. First of all, I'm not a big box retail fan, but I will tell you that I used to drive to Target or Best Buy every other weekend. I'd leave the city. My tax dollars went to Virginia. Now I just walk up the street and there's a metro there. So funny little story. They built 1,000 parking space garage underneath this building because Target sort of demanded it. The funny thing is, the irony is that it's never full because it's so convenient to get there by any other means, including bus or metro or bike. And it's such a pain to get there by car because with this project, we actually narrowed the street to expand the sidewalks. So, you know, people take the path of least resistance. And if there's too much hassle or too much cost, it doesn't work. So they built this garage and we don't really need it.
Mm. So we're improving the streets, which of course has an infrastructure element and a beautification and all of those things. What else in terms of really getting from A to B though? I mean, of course, that's one element of it, but in terms of actually getting overland or underground.
Well, there's a few initiatives I'll talk about. One I'll talk about very briefly, which is that we are under construction expanding the metro out to Dulles, which is not—
Are they going
to
blow up the airport though?
No, I'm just kidding. No. But and it's not a very attractive airport, but it's an international airport. A lot of people use it, and it's heavily trafficked by automobiles. So that's a big improvement. And what you have to realize is between D.C. and Dulles, there's so many suburbs. And so routing the new Silver Line through Tyson's Corner is going to be really key in reinventing Tyson's Corner as a livable, walkable place. So that's one initiative. That's not—
And just for our international audience, so they know, I mean, really Tyson's Corner is upmarket area in Virginia, and is, you know, known for having one of the most upmarket malls, which you need to drive to, and it's really the end of the line for the train, correct?
Yes, and it is really suburban and painful to travel through at any time of day. It was poor planning, basically.
Right.
So that's one small thing. In terms of what we're doing here in the district, and my focus really is on increasing the quality of life for district residents. I mean, we also have to prioritize people coming in and out of the city. You mentioned the congestion earlier. We are the center of the region when it comes to the economy. And we have, you know, 700,000 plus people that come in every day. But my job is to create a great quality of life here so we can go from 600,000 residents back to 800,000 residents, which is what we had in 1952 before we got rid of the streetcar, before white flight, before the riots. And so we're doing a number of things. One is we're rebuilding the streetcar system. I don't know if we'll ever rebuild 235 miles of system because the cost would be about $11, $12 billion. And unfortunately, we paved over it. But we are looking at a $1.5 billion investment, and we do have two lines under construction now. So that is very important. And that stimulates economic development and is also an environmentally friendly way for people to get around. And developers believe in it because they know that it's not going to go anywhere. A bus line can go away.
Right.
And the other thing I want to talk about, and I'm really proud of this, our new Capital Bike Share program. We were the first in North America to launch a bike share program. It was a pilot with 100 bikes and 10 stations. When we went to expand it, the company that was running it is an advertising company, and they really weren't that interested in expanding. They've been bought out by Bain Capital. And so I went to Montreal. I looked at the Bixi system, phenomenal system, next generation system, modular, mobile, solar. And we very quickly turned around an RFP with Arlington County. And we're starting a regional system with 1,100 bikes and 110 stations. And this, I think people are underestimating the impact this is going to have on the district in the short term and the long term. We're talking about taking cycling from a secondary mode of transportation to a primary mode of transportation pretty much overnight. We're also trying to make infrastructure improvements within the city, sort of on a very small scale compared to what you would see in Copenhagen. But we want to get there. And when you're in a built environment, you really have to look at reallocating space away from cars and back to people. You know, because it's really about moving people. And what I like about the bicycle is the bicycle meets our sustainability goals, our livability goals, our anti-obesity goals, not just our transportation goals.
What are your benchmarks? Whether you're looking across North America, are there urban centers that you're looking to, or are you having to go further afield that you're looking at a Fukuoka, you're looking at a Helsinki, for example?
Yeah, that's a great question because a lot of times people compare us to New York. We're nothing like New York. the city is completely different density-wise, the height limit, the federal interests here. There's 28 different police departments in D.C. I mean, to put out a bike share program, it can take years. But we do look at New York. We look at San Francisco. We look at Portland and Seattle. There are other jurisdictions in the States doing some interesting work. But we absolutely look at Copenhagen. We look at Paris. There's a place called Ulm in Germany that's doing some interesting things with car sharing. So we look wherever people are doing good work.
Mm. Andrew?
I was interested about that, actually, about the car sharing point, because I wonder if that's quite a good way forward for a city that is so wedded to its cars. Because it sounds from what you're saying that there's some of these issues it will never be solved, because Washington is never going to be as dense a city as some places. So is looking at what happens with cars important to you as well? How people use their cars? Would you ever consider a charging system for Washington? How are you looking at how people work with their cars?
Well, I absolutely think car sharing is a way of the future in most urban environments, because, I mean, having sort of worked in the industry as it started and now seeing people's behavior, particularly younger people, as they're moving into the city, they just aren't as interested in owning a car anymore. I think for one thing, they do the math and they say, I don't really want to spend $1,000 a month, you know, between parking and insurance and all these things. So now that car sharing has become more mainstream in most large American cities, I think we're absolutely at a point where we could hit a tipping point with car sharing where it could be more prevalent than car ownership in urban environments. And DC is very interesting because it's very urban in Northwest, although there is still a height limit. But it can be very suburban as you get out into Ward 3, 5, east of the river. And it is a solution for a lot of people's transportation needs, particularly that last mile when they're trying to get somewhere from the metro.
Great. Gabe Klein, thank you very much. I look forward to the new Dulles Airport, though. I'm going to hold you to that. Even if it's not on the cards, I'm looking forward to it. You missed it at the top of the show.
All right.
The 90-minute wait on arrival is no great welcome to this town.
Yes, it's true.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're in Washington. Back in a moment. And you're back with Monocle Weekly, where it's time to say farewell to Washington, D.C.
Yes, and it's been very good. I've liked it.
Have you?
Well, I liked Hisham, and I liked our guest today. I thought we had a very good lineup.
It was a good lineup today. Yeah. Nice bit of music, Rob. Well done on that.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was good.
Good old Wale.
Steve, you look good sort of hanging on to Andrew's leg.
Yeah, I'll keep doing it.
But you're not joining joining for the Asia tour next week, are you? No.
No, I'm going elsewhere.
We have a magazine to put out.
Yeah,
remember that?
I'm told. Yeah.
And Sasha, we're leaving you behind, or where are you off to next?
I'll be in New York
right,
with all of you and back here.
Okay. Yeah. And with the whole sort of, you know, it was interesting listening to Ariana earlier. I mean, even though her book sort of steps, you know, slightly outside of maybe where all of this other sort of midtermism is, do you think it's also the, you know, the timing is no coincidence either, though?
Well, no, it's obviously a time when putting out a political argument of any kind will find an audience. But the thing about Ariana is I don't get the sense that timing tends to hold her back one way or the other.
When we sort of come up for this round, though, do you think, and it's you know, something that I think we go back and forth on, you know, at the magazine, you know, quite frequently, but last time round, it was, of course, you know, the power of the blogger. Now this is, you know, will this sort of be, you know, the Twitter election, you know, as well or not? Are we still sort of gravitating to, you know, what the Post says, or are we sort of concerned with, you know, with what sites like Politico are saying, or, you know, what Tina Brown's site is, you know, talking about as much? I mean, of course, it sort of, it increases the pace and the delivery and, you know, maybe some of the hysteria as well. But is the narrative still coming from sort of, you know, three or four principal sources?
Yeah. I mean, I think that cable TV still leeches off of newspapers to figure out what to talk about. Campaign ads still drive what newspapers write about. I think in the end, you know, most of what's on Twitter is stuff that is somehow derivative of something that started somewhere else. And I think campaigns are realizing that spending a lot of money on TV ads to say what they want to say is the best way to sort of start that cycle of dribbling downward to voters wherever they're going to end up consuming information.
Well, Andrew, I'm not going to be carrying all those books that you're going to be buying at Barnes & Noble before I get on the plane. A little bit from the left, a little bit from the right.
And it is interesting when you go to bookshops here, just how many of those political memoirs and political books there are, because it just doesn't happen elsewhere, does it? You know, we've got the Blair book at the moment, but you don't get successful political books really kind of hitting the mainstream market.
I mean, I don't understand how there will be a market for them, because very few of these books are anything that you want to spend more than 800 or 1500 words with, which is sort of what blogs are perfect for. Yeah. I mean, I these arguments don't hold up very well over length. And
I was just going to say, and the other funny thing is that there's a very defined audience. It's the people who already believe it.
Right.
You know, the interesting crossover ones are obviously something like a Tony Blair book, where suddenly even people who don't like him want to read it. But you know, most of them, it's just literally for their followers, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm.
I think it's probably time to say goodbye now and have maybe a word from our sponsor, Salty Oats.
Yeah. can give you warning, can give you dry mouth.
It can, absolutely.
So, did you not use your cough button this
I didn't
time?
Use my cough button. This is the great thing. But I've got a cough foot pedal, which is really amazing.
That's really good.
I know. Do you have one of those?
No, I can't put brakes on the show any.
I sort of wonder, though, because whenever we've done anything from an NPR station before, there's always a cough button. So maybe before you get your license to be sort of part of the NPR network, do you have a cough button
at
every mic position?
You can use it in direct amount to how many salty oats you've consumed, presumably.
I've got a bit of a dry mouth.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? go for it, Rob.
It's a wrap.
That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineer was Andrew Chadwick here at the studios of WAMU, or WAMU, right, Rob?
WAMU.
Which is at American University here in Washington, D.C. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us into weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our Monocle column on our site. Next week, we'll be back at base in London. Without Sasha, but maybe we'll hear from you next week. But for now, in Washington, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Robert Bound.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Sasha Eisenberg.
And I'm Steve Bloomfield.
See you next week. Bye-bye.